Listen to Today with Sean O'Rourke with the RTE Radio Player.
Now, with some answers to your parenting and indeed grandparenting predicaments, I'm joined by David Coleman, clinical child psychologist in our Limerick studio. David, thanks indeed for coming in. Now, before we get to the listener queries, can I ask you about the Greta Thunberg effect? We've heard anecdotally of children getting quite concerned, worried even about the impact of climate change. Commentators indeed, some of them worried about Greta herself and the burden of her getting adults to listen to her message. What do you think of it all?
Yeah, good morning, Sean. I mean, I think there's definitely something in it. I think the term eco-anxiety is one that's used quite a bit now. Again, a lot of it anecdotal. I'm not that aware, although I haven't been particularly looking at research in relation to eco-anxiety. But I do think that the idea, I suppose, that children are becoming more aware of the environment and more aware of the damage and the danger that's approaching in terms of the way we've been treating the environment is a very real thing. And certainly, I mean, I have a sister-in-law who works in the whole area of environmental education, and she, again, anecdotally, is coming across a lot of children and teenagers in her work who really are very concerned. And so they're delighted to be able to, I suppose, through the workshops and stuff that she gives, you know, have a sense of action. Because I do think that's one of the great antidotes to a rising anxiety is a sense of control that you might have. So, I mean, we don't have control over the actual, climate change that's going on at a personal individual level. But we do have control over our own actions in terms of the level of hope that we might have in regards to our local area. So the more that, you know, children can be encouraged to actually be out in the environment, be outdoors, be out in forests, be out by lakes, become aware of what's going on at a local level, then that allows them then to, if they need to, you know, be active in terms of protecting that environment as well. And, you know, even the days of action, I mean, you know, Greta Thunberg's every Friday being a day of protest. I mean, I think, again, for children and teenagers, that's a really useful way to actually also become aware of the whole idea that, you know, when things aren't right and you feel that they're not right, it's okay to stand up and say, I'm not happy with this. And again, that gives children and teenagers a small sense of control back. The difficulty, I think, because, again, she is a teenager, I think you're right, some people do worry that perhaps she's so personal involved in this that it might be bad for her, but we have to assume that she has trusted adults around her, you know, that she has, you know, more than one good adult who's able to support her and mind her and take care of her as much as she needs, because, you know, she's unlikely to be, you know, as involved at a global level as she is without the support of adults. And so we have to assume that some of that support is also focused on minding her emotional well-being in the face of it as well. But the other thing then, you know, when children and teenagers do worry about these things, sometimes as parents we can dismiss it because we don't necessarily share the concerns. And I mean, I'd be probably a better example of that because, you know, my awareness of environmental issues is probably a lot less than my wife's, for example. You know, she's very attuned to what's going on. And so, you know, when my kids talk about it, it's probably their mum who gives them greater support, whereas I might kind of, really? Because I'm just not that aware. Right. So again, from parents' point of view, the more we can become aware, the more we can support our own children.
David, to the queries. First one about a 10-year-old girl, the eldest of three, and she can't get to sleep until I am in bed. She is also afraid of being the only one in the house who is awake. She is a slightly anxious child, but this is a new level. She keeps coming downstairs asking when I will be going to bed. How do I handle this, asks the mum.
Yeah, I think the mum is dead right to recognise that this is probably something related to anxiety. I'm not quite sure why, you know, her daughter's anxiety has increased over the last while. But definitely when it comes to bedtime, we do need to feel relaxed and comfortable in order to be able to fall asleep. And so you'll often find that when children have underlying anxieties that their sleep can be disrupted. And so one of the things that this mum can do is rather than just focusing on, when her daughter comes down to her, make it her business to be up there going to her daughter. And so establish an idea that you're going to do checking visits on your daughter, because what that allows your daughter to do is to stay in bed. Because obviously the getting up and walking down the stairs is very disruptive. It's very hard to fall asleep when you're active. So if the mum can set up a plan that she'll go and visit every 5 or 10 minutes, then what that might do is allow her daughter at least to be reassured that her mum is still attuned to her, her mum is still very aware of her, and her mum is there to support her. Just, I suppose, I mean, it's interesting, we've had two queries about anxiety, and so, I mean, I'd be very conscious of that in terms of, you know, the children that I'm working with as well. And so one of the things, if you don't mind, that just to mention, I've done an online course for parents all about children's anxiety and how you can support your child with anxiety. It's called Scared Kids. So if people want to Google that, that might also be a real support for parents in both understanding and then dealing with the anxieties that children and teenagers present us with. Because I think as parents, you know, it is a bit of a minefield and we're not quite sure ever how to proceed with it.
That's a very useful resource, no doubt, David. Here's a different kind of anxiety, but perhaps one we need to be aware of. How do I explain Brexit to an 8-year-old boy and a 6-year-old girl? And by the way, I heard a story from one of my colleagues about an 8-year-old who thought he wouldn't be allowed to travel to London after Brexit and he'd never get to Harry Potter World. I mean, they do get confused and maybe a little anxious about this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to be honest, I'd say, you know, can you explain Brexit to an adult? Never mind to a child. I mean, I think, you know, the convoluted twists and turns that it takes and the politics behind it, you know, are really quite confusing. But, you know, at heart, I suppose what you're trying to break it down for a child is the sense that, you know, there's a sovereign nation out there, you know, the UK, they want to be in charge of their own customs and trade, and they don't want to be connected into the European rules about trade and so on. And so that's what they're trying to do, is extricate themselves from all of the old agreements that they had. And now they're trying to make new agreements about how they're going to, you know, do all the trade between the various countries. And so, you know, that in terms of kind of making it simple, that might be a way to explain it to young children. But again, you know, if your sense is that it's not just about the complexity of the political nature of it, but that it's also about an anxiety that things are going to be different and changed, then that's the bit to focus in on with the children, is to say, to try and explore with them what kind of things they are worried about, or what is it about Brexit that worries them. And so it might be something, again, in that kind of concrete way that we know 8-year-olds and 6-year-olds will think. It might be something concrete like that. Maybe, yeah, they won't be able to visit cousins, they won't be able to do certain things if they feel that Britain is no longer accessible to them. And so that might be about reassuring them that it just means there'll be slightly different rules, but we'll still be able to do things. It might be a little bit more expensive to do things, but we'll still be able to do these things.
Back to one of our more regular type queries, I suppose we can call him David. Hello, Sean or David. Some days we collect our 2 grandsons from school. They're as good as gold, mostly. They are 6 and 8 years old, lovely chaps, but they do not do what their parents say. As soon as parents arrive, they act up and cause huge drama, won't listen, fight with each other really loud, will not agree to listen to anybody, either parents or us then. I know it's their way of attention seeking, but it's excessive drama, crying, shouting and causing mayhem. Their parents try to gently bring them around. It never works. They try a cross voice, never works. A threat of cutting out time on their iPads is sometimes helpful, but not always. I hear lots of working parents have this trouble. The last thing any parent wants is to be arguing and getting cross with your children during the few hours you spend with them in the evenings. Where do you start with that one, David?
Guy, you know, the first thing that struck me listening to that was, you know, what are 6 and 8-year-olds doing with their own iPads in the first place? But anyway, that's a bit of a red herring. Again, I think the issue there is something to do with the underlying separation for the boys from their parents. And so the boys go to school, then they go to their grandparents. And when they're picked up by their grandparents, again, I could imagine, you know, grandparents being grandparents, that, you know, it's a very kind of warm, easy relationship. And so perhaps their grandparents don't feel that it's their job necessarily to put too many limits and so on in place. That said, when the parents turn up, one of the things that the boys might be doing is just protesting the fact that their parents weren't necessarily there themselves to pick them up from school, or even the fact that they had to be separate from them for the whole day. And so we often find that when children, you know, have been missing a parent during the day, that when the parent actually turns up, it's almost like they give the parent a back in the neck, you know, that they're, you know, they have this underlying kind of unconscious crossness with the parent for abandoning them for the day. And so that might be somewhat what's going on in this situation, that actually the children are trying to just show, if you like, a protest about the fact that they've been abandoned for the day by their parents. And so I think if the parents actually, rather than focus too much on the managing the behaviour bit, because I think we can get caught up in all the behavioural bits and trying to use behavioural rewards or threats and so on to manage that, focus on the emotion of it. Focus on the fact that, you know, it is difficult for their boys to be away from them for the day. Everybody's, you know, probably tired, and it's been a long day, both for the boys and for the parents. And maybe tap into that whole bit about missingness and what it's been like for the boys to be missing their parents. And that might actually allow the boys to begin to recognise that this is actually about the fact that it is hard being away from their parents from the day. And that might then allow them all to ease back into a more easy, I suppose, general sense of the evening.
David, one other one. I'll try and get through it quickly, looking at the clock. My 8-year-old son suffers a recurring nightmare for about a year now. It will happen a few nights in a row where he becomes very upset and comes to my room in a distressed state. It takes me time to settle him to sleep in my bed. The nightmare is that he's out playing his ball at the green in front of our house. He kicks the ball and it goes out of his view, and when he goes to retrieve it, it gets dark and the fear is there's someone coming to get him. The ending last week was that he got knocked down when going to get his ball, so it changed slightly to having an ending. Is there anything I can do to help him and to stop this nightmare?
So when when children have a recurring nightmare, the one good thing about that is that we all get to know the story quite well, including the child. And so what one of the things that they might like to do is to actually create a new narrative, a new ending for that same story. And so let's talk about the nightmare, talk about it with the child, and then create some ending that's much more positive, that actually allows him to be somewhat heroic and to protect himself. And so that might be for him that he has this superpower where he can create light whenever he wants. So he can send a glowing ball up into the sky that brightens up the whole of the environment. So he can always see where he's going. So even if the ball goes out of place, it's not going to get dark. Then it might be that when he goes, that in fact he has a little homing device within the ball that allows him to track the ball, and he will always find the ball. So what he then gets to have is a sense of control over what's going to happen at the end of the dream. And so when you kind of repeat that and talk about that and talk about the new story, that tends to work its way into the unconscious for the child, and then actually the dream loses some of its power.
David, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's David Coleman there. Didn't get to them all, but got to enough of them. David Coleman, clinical child psychologist, thank you indeed for coming into our Limerick studios.